Okay, probably it's a good time for us to start. And today's lecture will consist of two parts. First of all, I will finish with imaginary Gaussian integrals and then talk about Grassmann variables and integrals also of the Gaussian type that involve the Grassmann variables. So where did we finish last time? Last time, we tried to consider this integral that is very similar to the Gaussian integral we considered before. Only what stands under exponent is imaginary. So let's assume that a is greater than zero here. And we asked ourselves the question how we should calculate those types of integrals. The trick is to move to the complex plane and to consider the complex variable z equal to x plus iy and consider this contour in the complex plane z. So the contour consists essentially of four parts. The original part, basically the part that corresponds to original integral, is the part of the contour that coincides with the real x-axis. We consider the contour so that we move from the leftmost point minus r along the x-axis to point r, then consider the semicircle of radius r and move until we hit the line that constitutes angle pi over 2 with the x-axis. And after that, we move back and move along the other semicircle of radius r in the negative part of the x half plane until we hit the point we started from. So there are four distinct parts, and we denote them as follows. Our original path will be denoted by C1. This is the path along x-axis. Then this semicircle will be denoted by C2. This path along the line that has the angle pi over 4 with x-axis will be denoted as C3. And this semicircle will be C4. So, because our integrand is an analytic function, then the integral over the whole contour is equal to zero. This will help us to deduce the value of this integral if we can calculate the contributions arising from the other parts of the contour. So we can write schematically that the integral along the contour C, it can be written as the sum of integrals over these distinct four parts, C1, C2, C3, plus C4. Let's consider first what we have here on this semicircle. At C2, we have the following. If we introduce the variable z equal to r, times e in power I theta, then, and theta varies between 0 and pi over 4, then e in power I a z squared over 2 will be equal to exponent I a over 2 times r squared cosine 2 theta plus I sine 2 theta. We know that eventually we must take the limit r going to infinity because this semicircle is presumably infinitely far away. Thus, if we look at this expression and take into account that phi lies between 0 and pi over 4, we will immediately see that this sine is greater than 0. So this I and this I eventually give minus sine, and we can deduce that because r goes to infinity, this goes to 0 as r goes to infinity. So then, I still have space here. Then at C1, we have that this integral C1 is equal to what we need to calculate I1 at C3. Let's consider first C4. At C4, we can repeat these considerations and take into account that angle theta varies between pi and 5 pi over 4. Thus, if we repeat the same considerations, we conclude that the integral over C4 also tends to 0 when r goes to infinity. So if we consider the contribution arising from C3, then we notice that we can make also the change of variable in such a way that that the integration reduces to the simple integration along this line that constitutes angle pi over 4. So at C3, we make the substitution. Z equal to S times e in power I pi over 4. And S goes from plus infinity to minus infinity. Is this clear why it goes from plus infinity to minus infinity? Because the direction, we have the opposite direction to what we had on the part C1. Strictly speaking, let's put it this way, plus r to minus r, with r tending to infinity. Yeah. So here at C3, we have C3. So integral along C3, EIA z squared over 2 dz equal to, let's write in more details, from plus infinity to minus infinity, e I pi over 4 ds. And here, if we substitute this z here, I pi divided by 4 squared will give us simply I. And we're going to have minus a s squared divided by 2. So this integral is an ordinary Gaussian one. And we write this way. Integral from minus infinity plus infinity with the minus sign. We switched the order of the limits of integration. E in power I pi over 4 will be written as square root of I. And we have ds e in power minus a s square root over 2. And this will be eventually equal to minus 2 pi I divided by a. Thus, if we look at the fact that the integral over the whole contour is 0, we can write that I1 minus 2 pi I divided by a is equal to 0. So our integral I1 is equal to 2 pi I divided by a. This is our answer. I deliberately decided to include I and the sine of square root. Any questions at this point how we consider this in integral? So if you could notice from the derivation, it is really important in this derivation that A is greater than zero. So let me write this as a first remark. So here A is greater than zero, but one can repeat the similar derivation when A is smaller than zero. So one can have A smaller than zero as well. And it follows if we consider the contour not of this form, but of the other form, where we first move along x-axis, then go down until the line constituting angle minus pi over 4. So if we consider this contour, then we can repeat the calculation and show that I1 is equal to the same expression. So the case A greater than zero is not particular for this integral. For the ordinary Gaussian integral, we had to have A greater than zero. But here, we don't have. But we must simply consider two different cases by taking two different contours. Now, you should probably check this as an exercise. It's quite a simple exercise. Now, this way. Remark two. If we compare two integrals, ordinary Gaussian from minus infinity to infinity e in power minus x minus ax squared over 2 dx, if we compare this and this one, minus infinity to 2 to plus infinity, e I a x squared over 2 dx, and compare the results. This is the square root of 2 pi over a, and this is the square root of 2 pi I over a. Then we see that this integral can be obtained from the ordinary Gaussian integral by substitution, a going to minus ia. Albeit here we had to have a greater than zero, but here a can be both positive and negative. Then we can ask a question, can we use similar analogy, similar substitution to obtain the value for the integral that is more general and contains matrix A that is imaginary? So if we compare the integral we considered yesterday, A, I, as a function of matrix A and vector B of this form, product of dxi exponent minus 1 half xi aijx j plus bixi with the integral I1 of a b product of dxi e in power here I over 2 xi a I j x j plus b I x I. Here we have I over 2. Then we can deduce that this integral can be obtained from this integral by substitution. A I j going to minus I A I j, and for the inverse matrices A minus 1 I j going to plus A minus 1 I j. So this just means that if we use these substitutions for the value of integral a a b equal to 2 pi in power n over 2 divided by square root of determinant a times e in power 1 half b I a I j b j, then if we use this substitution, then this integral I goes to I1 A B equal to 2 pi I in power n over 2 divided by the square root of determinant A times E in power I over 2 BI A minus 1 IJ BJ. So the whole purpose of drawing this analogy was to obtain the value of this integral that is also common in field theoretical applications. You will encounter this integral when you consider path integrals in Lorentz space-time framework. It is essential that there is a prefactor I over 2 in the exponent. Any questions at this point?
I may have just forgotten something, but on the top board, where did the IQ over 2 R squared come from?
It's an IA.
It's IA.
Oh, OK.
Yeah, it's just IA. Yeah, it's not IQ, yeah. I didn't really write this one. Sorry. Yeah, it's just IA. Any other questions?
Is it inverse matrix?
Yes, this is inverse matrix. Yeah, I denote it as A minus 1.
It's
the IAB should be A minus
1. Here.
In the other one.
Here it is
in the other one.
And here, yeah, of course. It's also inverse. Thank you.
So this somehow justifies the fact that if I take the Gaussian integral at left, where a can be any complex number, it will only exist if the real part is positive, right?
Right.
There is no condition on the imaginary.
Yes, absolutely true. Yes, in general, that's absolutely true. Okay, very, very good. Very good. So let's now consider a very interesting topic. The topic that seems a little bit daunting, but in fact, it is not daunting, and you don't have to be afraid of anything. I mean, the topic of Grassmann variables. How many of you saw Grassmann variables in the past? Okay, for how many of you, this name Grassmann variables is a completely new name? Okay, quite many people. You will need Grassmann variables when you consider the path integrals involving fermions. So when, in a couple of minutes, I will define what the Grassmann variables are, you will immediately see that there is a close analogy to fermionic operators in second quantization. So the algebra of Grassmann variables is very similar to that of fermionic operators. The only important thing is that Grassmann variables are not operators. They are just variables obeying some algebra. When we talk about operators, we imply that operator acts on something standing at the right. So we have one operator, it acts on something on the right, on some vector in the vector space. We have the set of operators, they act on some kind of a product of state vectors. But Grassmann variables don't act on anything standing on the right. They simply obey some algebra that should be respected when you manipulate them. So let me start with the following. What are Grassmann variables? So these variables were named after mathematician Grassmann, who discovered them or used them or formulated them in the past century, so a long time before the invention of quantum mechanics. So Grassmann variables are the variables that obey the following set of relations. If we have a set of Grassmann variables, probably a finite number of them or infinite, it's not that important, and label them as phi I are Grassmann variables. Then we simply state that these are the variables that obey the set of anti-commuting relations. Phi I, phi j plus phi j, phi I is equal to 0. Obviously, we can just write in the following way. Phi I, phi j equal to minus phi j, phi I. So order in which Grassmann variables stand matters a lot. And if we want to change this order, we have to anti-commute them and to take into account how many times we drag one variable past the other if we move one either to the left or to the right. Obviously, the square of one and the same Grassmann variable is equal to 0. These are just the definitions that follow from the major one. This means that in any expression, we cannot encounter a Grassmann variable in the product more than once. This means that phi I square root is equal to 0, then the third power of phi I is equal to 0, the fourth, and so forth. So if we want to define a function that involves Grassmann variables, let's talk only about normal non-Grassmann functions. I will tell what it means. So to define a normal function of one variable, let's call it phi as a function of phi. By normal, I mean non-Grassmann. So the function itself is not a Grassmann variable, albeit it's a function of Grassmann variable. So we simply assume that this function is not exotic. It is Taylor expandable. And it can be written in the form A plus B phi, where A is a normal number or variable, let's call it variable, normal variable. And B is a Grassmann variable. If we assume that B is a Grassmann variable, then we immediately imply that it anti-commutes with theta. I will write the anti-commutator in the using the curly brackets. So A is just a normal variable, it can be any number. And here we have the product of two Grassmann variables. So we cannot have the terms phi squared, phi cubed, and so forth. So if we have only one Grassmann variable and we define a function, then we have to limit ourselves to this very simple form.
So B is restricted to what, the space of Grassmann variables and,
yes,
and not like higher order parts of the Grassmann algebra or real numbers?
It is just a Grassmann variable. It is restricted to the space of Grassmann variables. So, and A is not a Grassmann variable.
And also, when we say that, for example, theta is a Grassmann variable, that means that it's allowed to vary over the space of the generating space of the Grassmann algebra.
What do you mean vary on the space, generating space? It belongs to the space of Grassmann variables. So,
as in, can it take up any value that is available for in the space,
yeah,
or set of Grassmann variable values? Any further restrictions on that?
So when you talk about the values for the Grassmann variables, what do you mean? I will explain that it, strictly speaking, cannot have any values. Any values from the space of real numbers. So you should not view Grassmann variable as a variable that can take the values 1, 2, 3, 4, 1 half, square root of 2, square root of 3, and so forth. So
you can define, for example, matrices that belong, that behave like Grassmann variables, right?
Right.
Will account like a representation of the Grassmann algebra somehow.
We will discuss this later. Yeah. Yes.
This function is a mapping from what to what, from like the Grassmann variables to Grassmann variables, or
it's a mapping from the Grassmann variables, better to say, to the space of ordinary functions. No, for a function, this function is not the Grassmann function. It does not belong to the space of Grassmann variables. So this just means that we can consider algebraic manipulations with this function. We can take the square of this function, say then exponentiate this function.
What is
similar
the
thing.
Output,
hmm?
What is the function output?
The function output. Consider no output. Consider just some abstract function. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
how do you add a normal variable with a Grassmann variable? Is that just formal? Like, what, I don't know.
And, so what is essentially here?
It's a number plus a Grassmann variable.
Number plus the Grassmann variable. So we'll see that whenever we have the even number in the product of Grassmann variables, this can be treated formally as a normal variable. So if we consider the function of more than one variable to make the things clear, so phi 1 and phi 2, we write a plus b1 phi 1 plus b2 phi 2 plus c phi 1 phi 2. So a and c are normal numbers, or no, better say normal variables. And b1, b2 are Grassmann variables. Grassmann. So we cannot think about anything else here, if we have just two variables.
Can we not have a product of a normal variable and
Grassmann? In general. So per product of a normal variable and the Grassmann variable. In general, you can have, yeah. But if you have many variables, then the coefficients, those normal variables, must satisfy certain relations. So you will see the illustration of this point a bit later when we consider Gaussian integrals. So okay, concerning, yeah.
Can you explain why C in this function is not Grassmann?
Because you have the product of all the product of Grassmann variables for phi 1 and for phi 2 there already. So yeah.
I want this F to commute with Grassmann variable. So you need an even number of Grassmann variables.
Yeah, you need the even number of Grassmann variables. Okay.
Well,
you want your F to commute.
So you just want to be able to do stuff with it. But, okay. Yeah. But that's just good.
The partial reason for this is that whenever you have the even number of Grassmann variables, they commute with other say even numbers of Grassmann variables. So essentially, they behave as normal numbers.
But so that's just a choice we've made that we want F to have this property.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We want to have this property exactly.
And when we say normal variables, we just mean that they're commuting elements.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. That they are commuting elements. They commute of all other Grassmann variables and with themselves. They're just commuting elements, and we can ascribe them some numbers from the real space. So it is a little bit unusual. The place where we encounter this will be just path integrals involving fermions. And what will be necessary for you is to know how one can do the Gaussian integrals, or the integrals that resemble Gaussian ones, over the Grassmann variables. But this is a bit later. In fact, when I checked the books, the physics books for physicists on quantum field theory, so I didn't find a lot of material devoted to Grassmann variables, because apparently in physics they have very limited applications. But the physicists may not even know all the peculiarities, all the depth of things related to Grassmann variables. So I'm basically telling you what physicists should know and how you should deal with those if you encounter the variables in more complicated expressions. the need for these variables will be clear when you will be dealing with path integral approaches in quantum field theory. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to consider them. Because a quantum mechanics evolving fermion deals with operators. Operators and pretty much all physical quantities could be calculated using operator formulas. Okay, so let's continue with our set of definitions. So derivative. The derivative is defined as strictly speaking, this is the so-called left derivative. Df over d theta equal to minus b. Why minus? Because if you look at the function f and take the derivative with respect to theta, then what you have to do, you have to move theta to the left in the expression and then skip it. This is the rule. Of course, you shouldn't view this derivative as some function that gives you an output. So anti-commute theta there with b, and then just skip b. A is a quantum. It does not enter this definition. Equal to a plus b. So we can also write we can check that the operator of taking the derivative satisfies this condition, d over d theta, comma theta, equal to 1. So you can check this by applying this to this function. It's just a simple exercise. But this definition is important when we consider many Grassmann variables. There, we also can write that for many Grassmann variables, we have the following set of relations: anti-commutator of d over d phi I, comma phi. So sorry, it's theta. I constantly confuse these letters. D over d theta I, comma theta j equal to delta I j. This is the Kronecker symbol. And d over d theta I, comma d over d theta j is equal to 0. So the derivatives related to different variables anti-commute with each other. So in fact, you can view the derivative of a normal function over the Grassmann variables as a Grassmann variable as well, because b is a Grassmann variable. And here we have the relations that pertain to Grassmann variables. So this definition means, it follows from these definitions, that d over d theta I squared is equal to 0. So it is completely clear that you cannot differentiate the function more than once, because in each and every expression, you have theta entering only once, only in the first power, but not in the second. So this relation is clear. But this relation means that you cannot have also the normal that exists in the space of real numbers and real functions, definition of integration over Grassmann variables. So what people assume is that the integration is defined as an operation identical to differentiation. It seems weird, but this is true. So this is our definition. If we have this function of one variable and the derivative. And another definition will involve the operation of integration d theta f of theta equal to df of theta over d theta equal to minus b. This is just another definition. Definitions. Quite bizarre, right? Yes.
I'm a little bit confused how you can differentiate twice, because the differential operator takes us outside of the space of functions. Like minus b is not of the form a plus b beta.
Minus b is just
a Grassmann variable?
Yeah, it is just a Grassmann variable, yeah.
But it's not a function because it's not of the form a plus b beta. Like what's a and what's b?
It's not of the form. It's a Grassmann variable, yeah.
You can apply the differential.
No, yeah, right.
So it's on the Grassmann variable.
How can you take the derivative twice? Like in the
twice?
Yeah.
Here, you mean from this expression?
So no, like the one on the left. Well, I guess that's a multiple variables.
There's a multiple.
So I guess
here you have anti-commutative differential of operators involving multiple variables. Yeah. So any other questions? Yeah.
I'm having trouble interpreting the anti-commutator of d by d theta and theta.
Good question. Yeah, sure. Sure. So d over d theta acts on what stands to the very right. So this is very, very good. This is the relation that implies that we have at the right function f of theta. So basically, the whole relation acts on f of theta.
Okay.
In this respect, this is similar to operators.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Because the differential operator, even in the space of Grassmann variables, is an operator. Yes. Yes.
So we no longer have the fundamental theorem of calculus?
Pardon me?
We no longer have the fundamental theorem of calculus.
No. You shouldn't be applying anything that comes from the theory of calculus pertaining to ordinary variables.
Can you explain again why integration of Grassmann variable function
is equivalent to differentiation? This is just the definition. Definition that is motivated by the fact that we cannot differentiate more than once, yes.
All right. So I can integrate more than once.
Of course, yeah.
It's a little bit, I don't know.
A little bit bizarre. So let me spell out what follows from this definition. So from this definition, it follows that, let me use this chart. It follows that we must have the following rule. D theta equal to 0 and D theta times theta equal to 1. So these statements are completely equivalent. So if you take this function f of theta and substitute here, then this definition fulfills only if you have this set of relations.
Right, but if I integrate a derivative at 0, right, because we can
This is what people use.
Who are these people?
This is what this is the definition. So you have this function of one variable, the only one that you can have. You introduce the operation of integration, then you have to assume these rules.
So here, I shouldn't think of differentiation and integration as inverse of each other. Right.
Yes.
So through the definition of integration, you've got that it should the integration of theta should be equal to b, which is a Grassmann variable, but you've got it here being equal to 1, which isn't. So I'm struggling to see what those two are.
So, okay. So equal to 1. So d theta is the Grassmann variable, right? You integrate over it, you get 0, and this is equal to 1. Let me check the correctness of this definition. You're using function phi.
Because you put here that you should be getting minus b, and b is a Grassmann variable. But here you'll get your not getting the Grassmann variable.
Because that's not a function.
Let me do the algebra here. So check. A, right? Plus. So this, according to this definition, it's 0. And if d theta times theta is equal to 1.
But when you defined it earlier, you said b was a Grassmann variable.
Yes.
So 1 isn't
Grassmann. Yeah. You do the following. You anti-commute b with either theta or d theta and get. So this is 0. And this is minus 0 minus b. This is 1, and this is minus b. Yeah.
Is there any sense in which this integral provides a measure on a space?
Okay, let's probably continue. Yes. So the integrals, of course, have no limits here. This is just formal definition. The sign of integral is more like a formality. Okay, let's continue. So if we have more than one Grassmann variable, then we can also define the operation of integration over the space of many Grassmann variables. D theta 1, D theta 2, and so forth, D theta n times theta n, theta 2, theta 1 equal to 1. It is important that the order in which the expressions stand here matter. So this is equal to 1. It is a convention. I believe you can encounter other conventions. But let's assume this convention. So in their innermost part, d theta n stands next to, actually it's the theta d theta n stands next to theta n.
Is that a definition, or does that follow from the previous definition?
It follows from the previous definition, but the order in which variables stand matters.
But how do you define that? Do you just define it by doing each integral individually?
Yes, exactly. Yes, you define by doing this each integral individually. So you first eliminate this d theta n theta n and so forth.
Okay. Yeah, because d theta n would be one n.
Yeah, one and so forth. Yeah.
So
principle, I could separate this integral by commuting everything past each other and write it as
yeah, by anti-commuting, better to say. Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. In principle, yeah. So differentials are also Grassmann variables. You should remember this. And they also anti-commute. So a good example will be the following, two variables. Two variables. So d theta 1, d theta 2, theta 2, theta 1 is equal to 1. But d theta 2, d theta 1, theta 2, theta 1, equal to minus 1. We anti-commuted this differential. And d theta 1, d theta 2, theta 1, theta 2, also equal to minus 1. We anti-commuted the regular variables standing here. So a difficulty here is that you always should be watchful regarding the order in which expressions, the variables stand under the sign of integral. Then one can perform also the linear transformations with respect to Grassmann variables. Right, with respect to, and you can have a product of a normal variables, just a number with the Grassmann variable. For example, if we have, so for two Grassmann variables, well, and for many, it's just an illustration. Theta 1, theta 2.
No.
We can define the new Grassmann variables. Theta equal to theta 1 plus I, theta 2 divided by the square root of 2. What we did here, we multiplied the Grassmann variables by the complex number. We can also multiply by the real number. And theta bar equal to theta 1 minus I, theta 2 divided by the square root of 2. But when we define the linear combinations of already existing Grassmann variables, so invoking either real numbers or complex numbers, we must get the new set of variables. And these variables must anti-commute. So check that theta, theta bar is equal to 0. So we cannot say, we cannot do the following. Say we have several Grassmann variables, and we construct arbitrary linear combinations out of them and declare them Grassmann variables. It is important that we construct such linear combinations that the resulting new linearly transformed set also obeys the anti-commutation algebra. So and also one can check that d theta bar equal to d theta 1, d theta 2. So in this case, theta and theta bar are also independent. Grassmann variables. And also, we can write that d, theta bar, theta is equal to 1. So using these definitions, we can move forward. And I have to use this side of the board. And we can move forward and deduce our first useful result.
Yep.
So somehow the Grassmann variables themselves form a vector space, right?
Well, they can form by so what do you mean by vectors? They can form a space, of course.
Right, but the thing is, if you're talking about independent Grassmann variables, I'm thinking about linearly independent, right?
Yeah. So yes. Yes. Linearly independent. Yes.
Multiplication, but a complex number, it must. For it to have sense, I must consider the Grassmann variables as spanning a vector space itself, right?
Right.
And if I endow it with that condition up there, that generates the Grassmann algebra.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
it. That's mm-hmm.
The point is, as I said, that if you want to form the linear combination of your Grassmann variables, then you can choose the particular linear combination that the resulting variables. So I may also this Grassmann.
Right.
So okay, let's move forward because time is running quickly. So let's calculate this integral. D theta bar d theta so of exponent minus theta bar a theta let's calculate this. Look, here we have two Grassmann variables and a is an ordinary number. It's a real complex, it doesn't matter here, and you don't have to worry, of course, about the convergence of the integral because there are no limits. There are no limits. It's purely a formal definition. But we have here a function. We have here a well-behaving exponent. And what we should do, we should assume really that if we have a good function of something involving Grassmann variables, then we can Taylor expand this. So Taylor expansion in all this machinery works and used, and this is our probably primary tool we should resort to when we want to interpret something that has a function of the product of Grassmann variables. So Taylor expanded exponent we have. D theta bar d theta 1 minus theta bar a theta. Can we have anything else?
No.
We can't have anything else. And what we need to do, we just invoke the definition that are written there. So we have 0 plus integral d theta bar d theta. Theta, so beta to write as minus theta bar a theta, and what way we're going to have out of this?
You exchange the
differential. A.
Absolutely. A. We anti commute this two and use this definition. It will be a. Then let's calculate the other thing. D theta bar d theta. Theta bar e in power minus also theta bar a theta. Again, we Taylor expand exponent theta bar. And what we're going to have?
First term gives us a 1, and then
one. Yeah, one, because here you have two Grassmann variables theta bar squared.
Yeah.
It will be just one. Oh, yeah.
Okay, back on this board up here, you say d theta bar is equal to d theta 1, d theta 2. And I can't figure out how you get that relationship. I think there should be like an I in there or some constant up front.
Okay, let's check this a little bit later, okay? Okay, so. So let's check this a little bit later. So now let's calculate more complicated integral. So let's calculate the following. So consider n Grassmann variables, or better to say two n Grassmann variables, theta 1, theta n, theta 1 bar, theta n bar, all independent. Just assume that they form a vector space. So bar doesn't mean anything particular. We could have put star or something else. So they form the space, and we're working in this space. Yeah.
Could you just have numbered them theta 1, theta all the way to theta 2n?
Absolutely.
Bars as well?
I simply decided to denote this for the future integral. So what we should know that the pairs of this variable all commute. So if we take pair, for example, of theta 1 and theta 1 bar, and it commutes with all similar pairs. So if we consider this integral I equal to product of d theta I bar d theta I, let's write it this way. Exponent minus sum over I lambda I theta I bar theta I. How are we going to proceed? We note that those pairs commute. So all pairs theta I bar theta I commute with each other. If they commute, then we can substitute the exponent of the sum by the product of the corresponding exponents and use the definition above. We can just write that this will be the product of d theta I bar d theta I e in power minus lambda I bar theta I. We just separated the exponent. We have one exponent, and we form a product of exponents because these pairs commute from each other. Here we have a complete analogy with the quantum mechanical operators. And this will be equal to the product over I of lambda I, where we used the definition of the corresponding integral written in the first line above.
Where is the relationship between theta bar and theta?
Completely independent here.
Yeah, there is no such conjugation between both. One is the conjugation of the other.
No, it's
so
not.
It's just a matter of notation that mm-hmm. you use to make it a little bit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You will see that when we try in the remaining time consider the main integral. Those theta and theta bar will stand in the combination that resembles the ordinary Gaussian integral. So this is what we have in field theory. So, but they are not conjugate. They're not complex conjugate. They're not Hermitian conjugate. They are just independent Grassmann variables. No conjugation, and this should not be viewed as a conjugation. Okay, and finally, we will consider the integral that will be the last integral considered during this lecture. The integral I will denote as J, a function of matrix A and vectors in the space of Grassmann variables, equal to product from 1 to n d theta I bar d theta I times exponent. This one, times exponent of the following, minus phi I bar A I J phi J plus B I star phi I plus B I phi I bar. So let me explain what means what. Aij is a Hermitian matrix. It's not real symmetric as we had for the case of ordinary integrals, but it is a Hermitian matrix. And all Bi and Bi star are independent Grassmann variables. I will put GV. So despite the fact that we have star here and here we don't have star, we consider them again independent. Similar, of course, we integrate over theta I bar and theta I, and they are also independent Grassmann variables, as we discussed above. So since I don't have much time, I will just write the basic step bigger, because we must finish today with this material. So how are we going to proceed? We are going to proceed as follows. We first make a shift of variables. Step one, make a shift of variables. Or better to say the substitution, theta I equal to eta I plus A minus 1 ij, theta j, B j and theta I bar equal to eta I bar plus A j A minus 1 B j star. So eta I and eta I bar are the new, comprise the new set of independent Grassmann variables. And it's a very good exercise to check the algebra, to check that eta I and eta I bar are new independent Grassmann variables. So, and as a result of this operation, we get that what stand? What stands under the sine of exponent? As a result, minus theta I bar A I j theta j plus B I. So I am using, of course, here the Einstein's summation convention. So there is a summation over all repeated indices. And I don't have one half here. Mm-hmm.
In the first one, is it AIJ, and the one below is AJI?
Yes,
it's to be swapped.
Yeah.
Okay.
Here,
yeah.
AIJ. And here?
AJI. Okay, supposed to be.
One second.
You have I remaining in the.
The summation is over J.
Right, but the order of the indices is swapped from the one
yep.
at the top. That's what I'm asking.
The order of indices here is important. So and it is important when you check this result. Bi star theta I plus Bi theta I bar goes to exactly here the order of indices is important.
Can you explain why the indices are switched?
Because you're taking the conjugate Hermitian.
It's just the definition. You can switch the order of indices.
Okay.
You can switch the order of indices. Nothing prevents you from doing this. But as a result of the order of indices, as we have here, this expression under exponent goes to minus eta I bar. Mm-hmm. A I j eta j plus B I star A I j minus 1 B j. So a good exercise to check this. Of course, you should keep in mind the order in which the Grassmann variable stand. You should not allow yourself during those algebraic manipulations arbitrarily interchange the orders in which things stand. This is the most unpleasant thing when you do manipulations with Grassmann variables. Yeah. So, and as a result, you are going to have the following expression. I'll probably use the remaining 7 minutes. So J A B star equal to 2 integral product D eta I d eta I bar times d eta I exponent minus eta I bar a I j eta j plus b I star a I j minus 1 b j. So this is the constant. The constant is the part that contains a pair of Grassmann variables, and these Grassmann variables are independent of this. And you can separate this part of exponent from this part. So, but What we are going to do next. In general, Aij is not diagonal. Everything is fine if it is the diagonal, but it is in general non-diagonal and Hermitian. If it is Hermitian, then we can invoke the same line of reasoning we used yesterday to consider the ordinary Gaussian integrals that involves the symmetric real matrices. If Aij is Hermitian, then we can write that Aij can be diagonalized. With the help of using some unitary matrix U. U here is a unitary matrix, meaning that those combinations UKL, LALM, U minus 1 MN equal to lambda K, if K is equal to N, and zero otherwise. This just means that if we apply this unitary transformation to our old Grassmann variables, eta I bar and eta I, we will have that if we introduce eta bar with prime, for example, k this way, equal to eta I bar u minus 1 I k, and eta n prime equal to u n j eta j, then these are again our new set of Grassmann variables labeled with primes. We will see that as a result, eta I bar Aij eta j goes to, so I'll say this one, goes to the sum of over k that labels the eigenvalues of the unitary of eigenvalues of our Hermitian matrix A. So this will go to eta k bar prime lambda k eta k. So using this transformation, this part becomes the diagonal, as we had before. And a bit more complicated, and I will not even tell about the details because we don't have time. Thing is to show that using this transformation, we have that the product over I of d eta bar I d eta I goes to the product of d eta I bar prime d eta I prime. So because the transformation is unitary, the measure is not changed. So to show this, one requires to use the unitarity of the matrix and the definition of determinant.
The prime one they will still have to satisfy the graph one?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Both eta and b are independent Grassmann variables, right? But between them, they have to anti-commute.
Yeah. Right?
So I cannot take the constant part of the exponential out of the integral just as easily as
so
did before.
So you can because here you have the pair of Grassmann variables, and here you have the pair of Grassmann variables.
So the fact that I have okay.
So simply because you deal with pairs, so each pair commutes with each other pair. So that is a good thing.
Okay.
So if you want to see how this is shown, just check my lecture notes. I will put on the wiki. So as a result, we are going to have our final expression.
Isn't the Jacobian zero in this like whole setup? The Jacobian is
zero. Jacobian is one. Sorry.
Is one.
Jacobian is one, because the transformation we are using is unitary. It is possible to say
D theta d theta. No.
But so, if you look over there, doesn't that suggest?
No.
So we have the following: J of A, B. There. Star equal to.
Can differentiate one.
Equal to. Exponent of bi. Bi dagger, or sorry, bi star a ij minus 1 dj times the product of lambda I, and this is equal to exponent bi star a I j minus 1 bj times the determinant of a. Note the determinant of A, the determinant of the matrix standing in the exponent is in the numerator, but not in denominator when we deal with the Gaussian integrals involving Grassmann. Okay, that's all. Thank you.